All right. Good evening, everyone. Let's begin. So we're going to take a little bit of a break from our normal limud. Normally, we study the parasha each and every week. This week, we're going to focus a little bit on Hanukkah, and to try to understand perhaps a little bit of a deeper meaning within this Yom Tov, a little bit of a deeper understanding, a deeper appreciation, which hopefully will Amir Tzah Hashem inform our appreciation, understanding of the upcoming Yom Tov. So I actually want to begin from a little bit of a different perspective. Let's begin with number one. So the Torah writes, V'samachta bechagecha, ato ubincha ubitecha, va'abducha, va'amascha, va'alivi, va'ager, va'yosom, va'amana, asher b'sharecha. Torah gives us the mitzvah of simcha, the mitzvah to rejoice. And the Torah tells us that we are supposed to rejoice on our Yom Tov, and I'm supposed to do it myself, together with my son, my daughter, my servant, my maidservant, the Levi, the convert, the orphan, the widow, all of those who are within my gates, I'm supposed to rejoice on Yom Tov. Of course, the obvious question becomes, how does one fulfill this particular mitzvah? So the Rambam writes the following, number two. The Rambam writes, Yomim Tovim, Kulam Asurim Behesped V'tanis. On general Yom Tov, a person is not permitted to go ahead and engage in hesped. Hesped is eulogy. Ta'anis is fasting. V'chayiv adam lihios bohen sameach v'tov leiv. And a person is obligated to be in a state of simcha, happiness. Tov leiv means general. Again, tov leiv means a good mood. What the Rambam is referring to, by the way, is a very interesting idea, which is on Yom Tov, behavioral joy is not enough. One must actually experience emotional joy. So that's Sameach v'tov leiv, hu ubana v'ishto, v'chol b'nei beisiv v'chol anil v'malav, everyone in the household, shene emar v'samachta b'chagecha. Now the Rambam writes, af api, shasimcha amura kan hi karban shlomim, kimo shanu mevarin b'ilchos chagiga, yesh b'chla also simcha l'smach hu, uvanav u'b'nei beiso kol echad v'echad karaylo. Now, what the Rambam writes is that biblically, when the Torah speaks about simcha, simcha, rejoicing, joy, has a very specific definition, namely, in the form of a karban shlomim. So what's a karban shlomim? So remember again, in the days of the Beis HaMikdash, when you went up to Yerushalayim for one of the three pilgrimage festivals, or Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, so if you wanted to eat meat, you would bring a carbon shlamim. That carbon, again, part of it is offered on the altar, part of it is given to the Kohen, and a large part of it is consumed by the owner. So the Rambam writes, when the Torah speaks about simcha, technically speaking, it's referring to the offering of carbon shlamim. Why does carbon shlamim make you happy? Because you have meat. Where there is meat, there is happiness. Right? Jews are very easy to please. Right? So the Rambam writes, although technically speaking, v'samachta refers to karban shlamim, we extrapolate from this idea that God wants us to be in a state of joy, that on Yom Tov, everyone has to have what makes them happy. And therefore the Rambam goes on in number three, ketzad, so how does one fulfill the mitzvah of simcha? Haktanim nosim and kalayos ve'egozim u'migdanos. For children, what makes children happy? Nuts, McDonald's, different food times have changed a lot, right? So again, apparently children were much lower maintenance in the times of the Talmud. So you give a kid a couple of nuts or a nice piece of candy, and suddenly again, the child is very happy. So that would make the child happy. V'hanoshim, for women, what makes women happy? Kona, I don't pretend to actually know the answer to that, but I'll quote the Rambam. V'hanoshim, kona lahem bigodim v'tachshitim noim. Kafi mamono. And again, how does a husband provide his wife with simcha, with clothing, with beautiful jewelry, in accordance with his means? V'ha'anoshim, and how are men happy? Ochlim basar, v'shosin yayin, they eat meat, they drink wine. She'ein simcha ela bebasar, ve'ein simcha ela bayayin. Because ultimately, again, there is no real joy without meat, no real joy without wine. And then the Rambam goes on to explain that what God also teaches us is a very important idea, which is that true simcha cannot be experienced if you're happy, but everyone else around you is miserable. True simcha is only experienced if you are able to go ahead and share that simcha with those around you as well. Therefore, the Torah goes out of its way to say that on Yom Tov, when you are rejoicing, you must take care of the orphan, you must take care of the widow, you must take care of the convert. What's the common denominator between the widow, the orphan, and the convert? Very often, they lack an extended family structure. So because of that, when Yom Tov comes around, if you're going to be b'simcha, you must share your simcha with them as well. So the simple question I want to try to explore tonight is there a mitzvah of simcha on Chanukah? is there a mitzvah to rejoice? Remember, we know that we have mitzvahs that we are obligated to observe on Hanukkah. The question is there a mitzvah to rejoice on Hanukkah? So let's analyze this. Take a look at number four. So remember, what we've established so far is that there is a mitzvah to go ahead and rejoice on at least the biblical Yom Tovim. Hanukkah, of course, is a rabbinic Yom Tov, a rabbinic holiday. Is there a mitzvah of Simcha on this rabbinic Yom Tov of Hanukkah? So let's look at the Gemara number four. The Gemara writes, "My Hanukkah, what is Hanukkah? What is the nature of this Yom Tov?" The Tanur Rabbanon, because the rabbis taught, "Bechafei beKislev Yomi deChanukah Tamnia Inun." On the 25th of Kislev begins the 8 days of Hanukkah. What happens on these days? Dilo lemispeid bahon, we do not deliver eulogies. Udilo lehis anos bahon, we do not fast on these days. Why? Shekishenichnesu yivanam lehecha, when the Greeks, it's actually the Syrian Greeks, and remember again, the Hanukkah story, just so you understand historically, takes place after the death of Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great dies, he leaves no heir. His empire, massive empire, is divided up among his five strongest generals. One of those generals happens to be a man by the name of Antiochus, and again, he takes over pretty much the entire Middle East. So that's the Syrian Greeks we're referring to over here. So what happens? So on those days, the Yevanim entered into the Heichal, they entered into the Beis HaMikdash, Timu Kol Ashron Shebeichal, they defiled all of the oils that were used to go out and kindle the menorah. Ukishe Gavra Malchus Beis Chashmonai V'Nitzchum, and when the Hasmonean, remember the Chashmonai were Kohanim. So when the Chashmonai family banded, it wasn't just the Chashmonai family, there were other soldiers as well. But again, it was the Chashmonai family who took the lead in raising the army. They overcame the Syrian Greeks. They searched everywhere, and they were only able to find one little flask of oil with the symbol, with the seal of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, which attested to its ritual purity. Of course, again, we're familiar with the story. There was only enough oil in that little cruse, in that little jug, to last for one day. Miracle occurred. And they lit, the menorah remained lit for 8 days until they were able to resupply themselves with oil. L'shana acheres kavum. So in the subsequent year, they established these days as a Yom Tov. And listen to this. V'asom yomim tovim bahalel v'hoda'a. So they made the days of Hanukkah into a Yom Tov. But how does the Yom Tov identity of Hanukkah express itself? In two ways. Halel, which is Hallel, which is Hallel. Literally means the recitation, literally the recitation of Hallel, and Hoda'a, which means thanksgiving, which expresses itself how? Alanisim, excellent. So again, the Gemara says, yes, it's a Yom Tov, but the expression of those Yom Tov is found in two specific ways, namely, recitation of Hallel, and the insertion of Alanisim, and the insertion of Alanisim, both of course in tefillah and prayer, as well as in Birkas HaMazon, in benching. So writes the Torah number five, the Torah quotes the Maharam of Rotenberg. So I quoted for you over here a little bit about the Maharam of Rotenberg. I think we actually quoted him a few weeks back. The Maharam of Rotenberg is a very important figure, besides the fact that he was probably one of the greatest Talmidei Chachamim of his particular generation. Maharam of Rotenberg also codified many responsa, which we still study and rely on to this very day. And of course, the Maharam of Rotenberg is also the one that established the halachic precedent for not ransoming captives for more than their worth. Remember, the Talmud already expresses this idea that if somebody is, God forbid, kidnapped, you cannot ransom them for more than they're worth because you incentivize kidnappings. The Maharam of Rotenberg himself was imprisoned, as you can read in his biography, and he instructed the Ashkenazic, Germanic communities not to ransom him because he felt that if they would ransom him, ultimately it would set a precedent. The Maharam of Rotenberg dies in captivity and is not buried until years after his burial. Literally, he died in prison, his body remained in prison, it's only a number of years later they were able to go ahead and finally ransom off his body. So the Maharam of Rotenberg asks the following. If you've heard the Maharam of Rotenberg contemporarily, it's because the episode, the story of the Maharam of Rotenberg was brought up by many when the entire issue of Gilad Shalit came up. When there was incredible discussion about whether or not there should be a prisoner release, whether or not Israel should engage in a lopsided deal to be able to go ahead and secure the release of one person. Very difficult to make that type of decision in a dispassionate, almost intellectual way. But one of the reasons advanced against a lopsided deal was because of the Maharam of Rotenberg, because of his tshuva, because of what he wrote, and because of what actually happened to him. So in any event, the Maharam of Rotenberg writes the following. Quotes number five.
Sheriboy hasu'ud shemar bin bohem. But Samar Romberg says, look, we look around and we see people have festive meals over the course of Hanukkah. Now the question is, what's the nature of those meals? So the Maram said, those meals, hein sudas harishus. What does sudas harishus mean? They are not obligatory meals. They're optional, meaning if people want to celebrate Hanukkah, you could celebrate Hanukkah as much as you want. You want to have a festive breakfast, a festive lunch, and a festive dinner every single day. That's absolutely your prerogative. But the Maram says, it's not an obligation. So you can do it if you want to, but it's what's called the sudas harishus. Why? Shelo kavu ela lahalel ulahodos. Because Hanukkah was only established by the rabbis as what? As days for halel and todah, thanksgiving, i.e. alanisim, velo mishta v'simcha. But there is no obligation, no mitzvah of rejoicing on Hanukkah. So this is the position. Remember again, the Talmud itself does not address this explicitly. All the Talmud tells us is that Hanukkah are days of Mishta v'Simcha. Excuse me, are days of Halal v'Hodah, days of Halal and Thanksgiving. The Maharam understands that literally to mean days of Halal and Thanksgiving, and not what? Not what? And not days of Mishta v'Simcha. On the other hand, look at number six. So the Rambam writes, the Rambam says, now the Rambam gives a little bit of historical background as well in number six. Kishagavri Yisrael alay vehem, va'avdum b'chamisha va'esrim b'chodesh kislev, v'nichnusu l'heichos. The Rambam goes through the whole Hanukkah story, number six. Now in number seven, umipneze hiskinu chachamim sheba osador, sheyiyu shmonas hayomim ha'ilu shetchilasam ila chamisha va'esrim b'kislev, yimei simcha v'halel. So look what the Rambam writes. So the Rambam says when the rabbis instituted the Yom Tov of Hanukkah, they instituted these days as days of simcha, rejoicing, and halal. Okay, so he goes on, umadlikin ben neros, we light candles, and he goes on to explain the various halachas of Hanukkah. So here, what we are faced with right now is the following. We have the Talmud that tells us that the rabbis instituted the days of Hanukkah as yimei halal voda, we recite halal, we insert alanisim. But is there a mitzvah of simcha? The Maharam of Rotenberg chooses to be a little bit of a literalist and says, no, the Gemara doesn't say anything about simcha. There's no mitzvah to rejoice on Hanukkah. There's no mitzvah for celebratory meals. There's no mitzvah for any type of celebration because that is not the mandate of the Yom Tov. But however, that's the Maharam of Rotenberg. The Rambam disagrees. And the Rambam says, no, the days of Hanukkah are yimei simcha, the halal. I agree on the halal part, of course, and Rambam's not disagreeing on the hodah. Of course, there's Thanksgiving as well, but there's also an element of simcha. What's the logic for each side? So now we're faced with a fundamental dispute between the Maharam of Rotenberg on one side and the Rambam on the other. What's the logic behind each of the approaches? So take a look at number eight. So the real question, of course, the question really is not as much on the Maharam of Rotenberg. Why is the question not on the Maharam of Rotenberg? Meaning, why do we not have to really wonder what the logic of the Maharam of Rotenberg is? Because our Maharam of Rotenberg is really just maintaining allegiance to what? To the Gemara. Because the Gemara says that the days of Hanukkah are Yemei Halal V'Hodah. So the Maharam of Rotenberg says, okay, the Gemara doesn't say anything about Simcha. Therefore, there is no mitzvah of Simcha on Hanukkah. But where does the Rambam get this idea that there is Simcha, there is a mitzvah to rejoice on Hanukkah, if the Gemara itself never makes mention of it? So look at number eight. This is from the Darki Moshe. The Darki Moshe is the commentary of Rav Moshe Isserles de Ramah on the Tur. Remember again, we're most familiar with the Ramah because Rav Moshe Isserles wrote like the footnotes on the Shulchan Aruch to make it Ashkenazically friendly. Because remember again, Rav Yosef Karo, the Mechaber, was a Sephardic Jew. He wrote a body of halacha for Sephardim. The Ramah came along and added in Ashkenazic footnotes whenever Ashkenazic practice differs from Sephardic practice. So the Darki Moshe, before he wrote this commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, he wrote a commentary on the Tur. So look at number eight. He writes the following, because V'kosov marat miprag v'zeleshono aval b'mordechai ha'aruch kosov by paragraph A u'megilas tanis amru shekavu yom tov Mishum Chanukas HaMizbeach. So first thing that Darki Moshe points out is, by the way, Hanukkah is not the only event that occurred during Hanukkah. Now, what does that mean? That it's not just simply the rededication of the Second Temple that occurred during these days, but what else happened? Something happened earlier in history, which was what? What he calls over here, the Chanukas HaMizbeach. Chanukas HaMizbeach was the consecration of the altar when? When? In the Mishkan. Remember, the altar was consecrated. We read about it in Parshas Naso. Every tribal leader brought his own set of offerings. When did that take place? That took place starting on the 25th of Kislev. So this is interesting because what the Darki Moshe is bringing us is bringing to the table now is that Hanukkah is not simply relevant for the events that occurred with the Syrian Greeks. There's an earlier significance to these days already, in that it was on these days that the Mizbeach, the altar in the Mishkan, was actually dedicated. And watch this. V'cheimash of a medrash, Rabasi Parshas Baloscha, Vahacha Omer Shekvoasa Mishumanes, Vishlomer Dimishumze, Kavu Mishtevisimcha, Avalahalahodos, Kavu Mishumnes. So Darki Moshe advances something very interesting, which seems to be the position of the Rambam, which is that we have two concurrent celebrations. We celebrate the dedication of the Mizbeach originally in the Mishkan, and we celebrate the rededication of the temple in the times of the Hashmonaim and the Syrian Greeks. And writes the Darki Moshe that there are two different observances for those two different events. When it comes to what we'll call colloquially Hanukkah, the victory over the Syrian Greeks, the miracle of the little cruse of oil. So how do we celebrate those days? That's Hallel and Hodah. We say Hallel, we go ahead and we add in Al Hanisim. But there's another miracle that occurred during these days, and that's what? That was the dedication of the altar in the Mishkan. How do we celebrate that particular event? And the answer is Simcha and Mishta, celebration. And therefore, again, we could use this Darki Moshe to explain that's where the Rambam gets it from. So if you go back up to number 7 for just a moment, when the Rambam writes that beginning on the 25th of Kislev, these are days of Yimei Simcha, days of celebration and days of Hallel, what the Rambam is doing is he's merging two smachot. Right, he's merging two incredible events. He's merging the simcha over the dedication of the altar in the Mishkan together with the Hallel and Hoda'ah of the actual Hanukkah story, bringing them together into one celebration of Simcha and Hallel. Rav Soloveitchik in number 9 writes the following. The Rav writes, he says again, I'll just tell you this. Well, actually, I'll read it to you a couple of lines, then we'll say the rest outside. Bahalal v'odah, avalo bisu'uda. Remember, interestingly enough, the Gemara says that all you celebrate Hanukkah with is Hallel and Hodah, but no mention of Seuda. V'ayin sham, fine. L'fi mashkas ha-Rambam, yimei simcha v'halal, yesh lomar di'ika mitzvah b'ribu ha-Seudos. So Rav Soloveitchik asks, I don't understand Rambam, where do you get the idea of simcha? Where do you get this idea of simcha if the Gemara never mentions simcha? Yesh lomar, ach tzarech yun, minolei l'ha-Rambam gufa davazeh. Where does the Rambam know this from? That there's a mitzvah of simcha on Hanukkah if the Gemara doesn't say it. De'ika chiyuv simcha b'chan, v'nira, de'lamad kein me'isser hespid v'tanis, u'michiyuv halal, de'hespid ha'vikiyam avelos. Rav Soloveitchik advances a very interesting idea. The Rav writes that where did the Rambam get the idea of simcha from? The fact that on Hanukkah, you can't fast and you can't deliver a eulogy. Now, generally, when are days that you can't fast or can't deliver a eulogy? When? On days where there is an obligation of simcha. For example, what are some other examples of days in which you cannot fast or deliver a eulogy? Right? So Rosh Chodesh is a little bit different because Rosh Chodesh is more customary than anything else. But halachically, Yontiv, right? I'm sorry? On Tisha B'Av? Sure. Tisha B'Av you can. If you can. But again, it's simple. You're thinking too much. Baruch Hashem is a smart group. Again, Yontiv, Chol HaMoed is a perfect example. Right on Chol HaMoed, again, remember, we bury the dead on Chol HaMoed. The truth is, remember, according to the Talmud, we bury the dead on Yontiv also. They used to bury the dead on the first day by instructing non-Jews to do it. And on second day of Yontiv, Jews would do it themselves. Again, you still find this, by the way, in Hasidic communities today. They still bury on Yontiv Sheni. And also, again, in the Breuer's community, they still bury on Yontiv Sheni as well, which is just interesting. In any event, with the point that the Rav says is that wherever you have a prohibition on eulogies and on fasting, by definition, that means that that day has an overtone of simcha, because it's only simcha that outlaws fasting and eulogy. So the Rav says like this, the Gemara does not have to tell me that there's a mitzvah of simcha on Hanukkah, because once the Gemara tells me that I'm not allowed to fast, and once the Gemara tells you that I'm not allowed to eulogize, what does that tell me? That by definition it's a Yom Tov, and not just any Yom Tov, but a Yom Tov with a mitzvah of Simcha. So again, so now let's take this a little bit further. Look at number 10. So now here's what we have so far. So now we've just explained the opinion of the Rambam in two different ways. Why does the Rambam, remember, the big question is on the Rambam. I know it's a little bit more of a technical shiur tonight. We're going to get to the hashkafic parts of it as well, but we need this buildup. We need this framework. So remember, again, our question is on the Rambam. The Rambam says that the days of Hanukkah are Yemei Simcha V'Halel. Halal works fine because the Talmud says that. Where does he get the idea that the Hanukkah is a mitzvah of Simcha? So we have two answers so far. Answer number one, the Darkei Moshe, the Rama, who explains that the Simcha of Hanukkah, says according to the Rambam, is not based on the Simcha of the Hanukkah story, but it's Simcha that comes from what? Chanukah's HaMizbeach, the dedication of the Mizbeach in the Mishkan. That's answer number one. No, they definitely made a yontif. The fact that they brought karbanos. No, it was a one-time event. But nevertheless, they celebrated once, but we commemorate this event each and every year. Now, it could very well be that maybe we didn't commemorate this event until the Hanukkah story itself. That's what it sounds like. I don't know if they were commemorating this before the Hanukkah. But once we started commemorating Hanukkah, the event Hanukkah, we started also commemorating the historical dedication of the altar as well. That's answer one. Answer number two says, the Rav, where does the Rambam get the mitzvah of Simcha from? From the fact, again, that the Gemara says you can't do what? You can't fast. You can't eulogize. That, by definition, tells us that there's a mitzvah of Simcha, even though the Gemara does not state it explicitly. What about the Maharam? Where is the Maharam of Rotenberg? The Maharam of Rotenberg says that there is no mitzvah of Simcha. Now, what's his proof? Simplest answer? The Gemara, right? Because the Gemara only says that Hanukkah are days of Simcha, of Halal and Hodah. So there's no mitzvah of Simcha. But on a deeper level, take a look at number 10. And this is a famous idea as expressed by the Mishnah Berurah. The Mishnah Berurah writes, Shelo kavum l'mishtev simcha, el halal ula odos. So why is it now? What the Mishnah Berurah does is something very interesting, because generally when we group Yomim Tovim, we put them into two different categories. We have biblical Yomim Tovim, Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkis as the Regalim, and then of course Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and then we have rabbinic holidays. And the rabbinic holidays are Hanukkah and Purim. So generally there are many similarities in Hanukkah and Purim. So what the Mishnah Berurah points out is there a mitzvah of Mishtev Simcha on Purim?
Yes.
Unequivocally, yes. That's of course. So I would have thought that because there is a mitzvah of Mishtev Simcha on Purim, that there is also a mitzvah of Mishtev Simcha on Chanukah. So the Mishnah Berurah writes, he says, why is it Viniratam Delo Kavu Kan Simcha Kimo Bepurim? Why is it that on Chanukah they didn't institute Simcha like they did on Purim? He says very simply, Ki Bepurim, excuse me, Hoya HaGzeira LaHashmid Ula harog es hagufos shehu bitul mishtev simcha velo es hanafashos. Remember on Purim, what happened? On Purim, what was Haman interested in destroying? Haman was interested in destroying the Jewish people. He was interested in death and destruction. Was he interested in proselytizing the Jewish people? Absolutely not. Right? That's the hallmark of Amalek. Right? Amalek is interested in the physical annihilation of the Jewish people. Even if the Jewish people are willing to yield on their faith, Amalek doesn't care. Amalek just wants the death and destruction of Klal Yisrael. So on Purim, where the focus of Haman was physical death and annihilation, Sha'afilu himiru datom chas hashom lahem mekabel osam. Even had we said to Haman, we'll convert to whatever religion you are, Haman would not have accepted us. Lekach, kishetzilim HaKadosh Baruch Hu mimenu, kavu lahalalo ulishabcho yisparach gamkein ayyidei mishtev simcha. So the Mishnah Berurah says something very interesting. The way you celebrate the Yom Tov is very much connected and tied in to the very essence of the Yom Tov. So on Hanukkah, on Purim, what the threat was? What kind of threat? It was a physical threat. Therefore, how do we celebrate the salvation of Purim? Through a physical salvation. That's why there's a mitzvah Mishtev Simcha. On the other hand, says in Mishnah Berurah, Masha'in kein b'ma'aseh da'antiochus. This was very different, of course, than Antiochus and the Syrian Greeks. Shelo gazer aleim larog lahashmid rak tsoros ushmados kedei lahamir datom. Remember again, this was the Greek civilization in general. Greece was always very interested in assimilating other civilizations and societies. They were not interested in wiping people out. They just wanted people to kind of join them in the building of their type of society. So when it came to Antiochus, the threat was not physical. The threat was spiritual. He wanted to rob us. He wanted to annihilate us spiritually, but was very content to leave us intact physically. Therefore, kemo shanu omrim lashkicham sorasecho ulaavir meukero tzarecha v'im ha'yisro machniyam lohem lios kivushin tachas yadam ulahalos lem mas v'chozun lemunosim chas v'shalom v'ha'yum mevakshim yoser ela shehigbir HaKadosh Baruch Hu yayisro. So therefore, again, you see where the Mishnah Berurah goes with this. The Mishnah Berurah says, but the nature of the threat on Hanukkah was what kind of threat? Was a spiritual threat. Therefore, how do we celebrate salvation on Hanukkah? Spiritually, namely through Hallel and Hodah. So this is the position of the Maram of Rotenberg. So remember, the Maram doesn't just simply say, well, it doesn't say Simcha in the Gemara, therefore there's no Simcha. I mean, we have to be a little bit more sophisticated than that. So the Maram therefore says, no, the way you observe a Yom Tov has to express the entire nature and motif of the Yom Tov. So if Purim represents a time of a threat of physical annihilation, therefore when HaKadosh Baruch Hu saves us, that is a physical salvation. Therefore, we express our observance of that Yom Tov in a very physical way. And in fact, Purim is probably the most physically, we'll call physical celebratory oriented Yom Tov we have. And in Hanukkah, where we faced a spiritual threat. Therefore, the way we celebrate the Yom Tov is through a spiritual medium, through the prism of spirituality, i.e. Halal of the Hoda'ah, and no mitzvah of Simcha. So here now we frame the fundamental dispute. Is there a mitzvah of Simcha on Yom Tov? And the answer is? Try that once more. Is there a mitzvah of Simcha on Hanukkah? I'm sorry, I said Yom Tov. Good. Is there a mitzvah of Simcha on Hanukkah?
Yeah.
It's a machlokes. It's a dispute. Right? That's always a safe answer in Judaism, right? It's a dispute. So we have, again, the Maram of Rotenberg telling us unequivocally, no. First of all, it doesn't say so in the Gemara. Second of all, Simcha is not in line with what Hanukkah is about. Hanukkah is about spiritual salvation. Therefore, our observance of the Yom Tov must express itself in a spiritual fashion. Rambam says, no, of course it's a mitzvah of Simcha. Rambam, how can you say it? The Gemara doesn't say it. Either because, again, the Simcha of Hanukkah is related to the Simcha of the dedication of the altar, or the Simcha of Hanukkah is related to the fact that it doesn't say anything about, the Gemara doesn't have to say Simcha for the simple reason that what? Once it tells you that you can't go ahead and fast, once it says you can't deliver eulogies, by definition that means there's Simcha. How do we paskin? Look at number 11. The Shulchan Aruch writes, Riboy HaSeudos. So now we have to see how do we paskin according in this machlokes. So Riboy HaSeudos, Shemar Bin Bohem. So the Shulchan Aruch says, now here's what's interesting about halacha. That sometimes halacha also looks at what people do. So it's interesting because what do you see people do on Hanukkah? People have fun. Good. Hey, people eat. Maybe that's not a raya. Hanukkah, not Hanukkah. Right? People have seudos. People absolutely have seudos. People definitely have more celebratory meals during Hanukkah than we do, perhaps again over the course of the rest of the year. I'm sorry. But even so, even without the obligatory washing, or to make it to what we'll call the halachic seudah, still you see that there's definitely an emphasis on more food over the course of Hanukkah. So the Shulchan Aruch says, look, I know what I've seen, I know what you've seen. Riboy ha-seudos, shemar ben bohem, heim seudos ha-reshus. It is true that people go ahead and have additional meals over Hanukkah, but those are not obligatory. Those are seudos harishus. Meaning again, even if there's not a mitzvah simcha on Hanukkah, if I choose that I want to have a nice celebratory meal, I'm certainly allowed to do that. There's certainly nothing wrong with that. So the Shulchan Aruch writes, yes, people have celebratory meals, but they're not obligatory. That's something that people choose to do of their own volition. Why? Shelo kavum lemishte v'simcha. Because the Shulchan Aruch says, simply taking the approach of the Maram of Rotenberg, which is interesting because very often Rav Yosef Karo sides with the Rambam, both Sephardic Halachic decisors, but here he doesn't side with the Rambam. Here instead he sides with the Maram of Rotenberg, siding with the explicit passage in the Talmud, because the rabbis did not institute these days as Simcha Mishta. Yeah?
I thought that the main miracle of Hanukkah was the winning of the war, which is physical.
No. That's it. No. So the truth is, there are two miracles, but there's no question that the emphasis of Hanukkah is on the Pach Shemen. That is the emphasis. The simple. Now, the why, that's a different shear. It's an excellent question as to why the emphasis would be on the Shemen as opposed to the war, but you can see that in a simple way. There's only one mitzvah of Hanukkah, and that mitzvah is menorah, right? So it's interesting. Again, and even in Halal v'Hodah, now some say Halal is about the war, menorah is about the ner, but the emphasis usually is on the Pach Shemen. So therefore, the Shulchan Aruch goes on. He says, Hagah, v'yesh omrim sheish ketzas mitzvah b'ribo yasudo. So the Rama writes that others say that there is no a little bit of a mitzvah to go ahead and have additional seudos. Mishum deba'osan hayomim haya chanukas hamizbeach. Interesting. So now again, you see what we saw the Darki Moshe stated before. Some say, no, there is a mitzvah to have a little bit of an extra seuda. Why? Because, again, of Chanukah's HaMizbeach, the dedication of the altar in the times of the Mishkan. V'noah gilomar zmiros. Okay, fine. So the Shulchan Aruch, essentially, Paskin's like who? Like who? Like the Maram of Rotenberg. Namely, there is no mitzvah of simcha on Chanukah. If you want to have celebratory meals, can you do so? Absolutely, but don't call it a mitzvah. Don't call it a mitzvah. They're sudos harishos. Okay. Now, if you look at number 12, actually, the truth is we don't have to go through the rest, because the Mishnah Berurah number 12 really just goes ahead and restates what we learned before. But perhaps, so now, essentially what we come out with is that we pass like the Maharam of Rotenberg, no mitzvah of simcha on the Yom Tov of Chanukah. So how do you observe Chanukah? Halel, hoda'ah, right? And of course, again, we're not speaking about it tonight, but the kindling of the menorah. But perhaps there is another reason why there is not a mandated mitzvah of simcha on Chanukah. Take a look at number 13. This is from the Maral of Prague, has a sefer called Ner Mitzvah, and it's all about Chanukah. It's all about Chanukah. See, he writes over here the following. He says, and if you look in paragraph 8, quotes the Gemara, perhaps one of the most well-known Gemaras when it comes to Chanukah, Tanur Rabbanon. Mitzvahs Chanukah, ner ishu beso, v'amahadrin ner l'chol echad v'echad, v'amahadrin min amahadrin, b'shame omrim yom rishon madlik shmona, mikan ve'ilech poches v'holech, u'besilo omrim yom rishon madlik achos, mikan ve'ilech mosev v'holech. So the Gemara talks about the following. If a person wants to perform the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah, mahadrin min mahadrin, the best way possible. So how does one do it? It's a dispute. According to Beis Shammai, if you want to perform the mitzvah mahadrin min mahadrin, the best way possible, you begin on the first night of Chanukah with 8 candles, and each subsequent night you remove 1 candle. So you begin with 8, about the time you get to night number 8, you are left with 1. Beis Hillel, on the other hand, says, no, you start with 1, and each night you add on an additional candle until the last night of Chanukah, you are left with 8. So the Talmud explains, what are they arguing about? So the Gemara says, Amar Ula Pligi Bat Shem Rai B'Ma'arava, Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Avin. So the Gemara gives all different reasons for it. It goes on, Chad Amar Tamei Beis Shammai Kineged Yamei HaNechnosim, V'Tamei Deisil Kineged Yamei HaYotzin. Beis Shammai looks, Beis Shammai counts by the number of days that are still left. So on the first night, you'll light 8 because you have 8 days of Chanukah ahead of you. Night number 2, 7. 7 days of Chanukah light. While Beis Hillel goes ahead and lights corresponding to the number of days that have elapsed. The Gemara gives another reason that according to Beis Shammai, he says that this mitzvah corresponds to the way that the offerings of Sukkis were done. On Sukkis, if you'll notice, we read this in the laning, we begin again with a higher number of offerings, and over the subsequent days, we decrease the number of offerings. So we have a biblical precedent for starting with a higher number and making our way to a lower number. So to inform in this mitzvah, Beis Shammai says you start with the 8 and you work your way down. On the other hand, Beis Hillel says, Ma'alin b'kodesh ve'ein moridin. When it comes to matters of holiness, we go up, we ascend, we grow, and we never go ahead and contract or listen. So the Maral says, what's going on over here? Right, there's got to be something much deeper to this machlokas, to this dispute. So look by paragraph B. And the Maral here says something. This, I think, is perhaps one of the most amazing pieces of Torah in Chanukah. He says the following, paragraph B. Keneged yamim ha-nichnasim. Perish, kishaholich achar yamim ha-nichnasim. Ki arishon, hu ha-haschola el akol. So the Maral, remember, this is in Beis Shammai's opinion. According to Beis Shammai, the first, number one, that is the beginning of everything. What does that mean? Paragraph C. Lekach hu yoser b'mala. Therefore, the first is always most important. Uki'ilu b'kocho Sharha Yomim Shem Acharav. It's almost as if the first contains the power for everything that will come after it. Ulafichach, Yesh Lahadlik Shmona, Keneged Yom HaNechnasim. So the Maharal says something amazing. According to Beis Shammai Shita is like this. When you start something in life, in order to be successful, says Beis Shammai, what's the recipe for success? The recipe for success in anything you do in life. I know that's a very open-ended question to a large crowd. Right? Beis Shammai would say, you must have a rock-solid foundation. If you start doing something in life half-hearted, or you start doing something in life, you're not really into it, you will not be successful. If your foundation is rickety, then you cannot build on top of it. So if you want to start something in life, you need to start 1,000%. Remember, what does Chanukah represent? Chanukah represents the rededication of the Beis HaMikdash. Remember, the Beis HaMikdash is also, each of us has a Beis HaMikdash in our heart, right? We each have the Bilvavi Mishkan Evne. We each ultimately, again, carry that Beis HaMikdash. So just like Chanukah is about the rededication of the physical temple, Chanukah, the Svarim Rite, is also about rededication of the self. So says the Beis Shammai, how do I go ahead and begin a new life initiative? How do I dedicate the self? And the answer is, you need to start strong. You need to start with as close to perfection as possible. Because if you don't, then no matter how good you are afterwards, it's no different than a building. You know, if you go ahead and that foundation is rickety, but it's okay, even though the foundation is rickety, I'm going to use the nicest building materials and I'm going to put on a nice roof and I'm going to use the most expensive windows. I'm going to do everything. What's going to happen to that house? It's going to fall down, right? So if your foundation is not solid, anything you build above it is ultimately not going to be sustainable. Therefore, says Beis Shammai, when you start on the first night of Chanukah, it has to be perfect. Perfection is represented how? By all 8 candles. Aye, then according to Beis Shammai, why don't you keep 8 candles the whole way through? Right? It's a good question. Because the answer is no one maintains 8 candles all the time. Sometimes it's 7, sometimes it's 6, sometimes it's 5. But here's the great news. As long as you start with 8, even if your light diminishes over time for some reason or another, you will still continue to burn. But if you only begin with 1, if your foundation is rickety, if the foundation is not solid, then at the end of the day, it's very difficult to sustain light like that. That's Beis Shammai. Hold on for 1 second. Look at Beis Hillel now. Skip down a little bit. He goes on, Ulaman Da'amar, it's actually in paragraph D, about 5 lines in. Ulaman Da'amar, okay, Ulaman Da'amar, look at 5 lines down, paragraph D. Ulaman Da'amar Keneged Yom HaYotzim, what about according to Beis Hillel, who says that you begin with 1 candle and work your way up? Ki maschilin bekatan, umesayim begadol. You begin little, but you end big. Why? Dimalin bakodesh ve'in moridin. We go up in holiness and we do not descend. Ki akedusha hi malo alyona ve'ein magia al madrega hazos alyona mitchila. See, listen to what Beis Hillel is saying. Beis Hillel is saying, my dear Shammai, it would be wonderful to start with 8 candles. But what's the problem? What's the problem? That's not usually realistic. It's not usually realistic to get all 8 candles burning at once. Instead, says Beis Hillel, what's the proper approach to life? Begin with 1. Build 1 into 2, build 2 into 3, build 3 into 4, keep building, keep growing, and it's okay. As long as there's a little bit of light to start with, you could fan that light into something bigger. Malin Bakodesh, as long as each night you keep on producing more light, that is good. So what the Maharal is saying over here is that the dispute between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel is not simply a dispute in the midst of Ner Chanukah. If Chanukah represents the rededication of the Beis HaMikdash, and each of us is a mini talking, breathing, living Beis HaMikdash, then what we're really trying to figure out in Chanukah is how do we rededicate ourselves? Chanukah, you know, it's interesting that in Hasidic literature it's written that you know when the Sefer HaChaim, when the books of life and death close, you know, it's interesting. So some people say Ne'ilah, some people say Ne'ilah, and others say when Hoshana Rabbah. Still others say Shemini Atzeres. In Hasidic literature it's written that they close when? Chanukah. You know, I always wondered, like, why Hanukkah? Like, what? First of all, besides that the Hanukkah is rabbinic, right? Why? What is the connection between the books of life and death and Hanukkah? But now we understand it. Because Hanukkah is an opportunity in the midst of the cold winter. It's an opportunity to reignite the spark. It's an opportunity to reignite the flame. It's an opportunity to rededicate myself. Just like our ancestors took a temple that was defiled in every single way and they rededicated it. So every time I light the menorah, I remind myself that no matter how defiled I may have become, because a lot could happen between Shmini Atzeres and between Hanukkah, no matter how what has happened during that time, I can rededicate myself. And so Beisham and Beisila argue, so what is the proper process of rededication? How does one rededicate their personal temple? Beis Shammai says, you have to start with perfection. You have to start perfect, even if you can't maintain perfection. You have to start perfection, because if you don't start with perfection, whatever you do is not going to endure. Beis Hillel says to Beis Shammai, my dear friend Shammai, conceptually, I agree with you. Who wouldn't want to start with 8 candles? But here's the problem. What happens if you wait to start the rededication of your temple until you're able to kindle all 8 candles? What happens? You'll be waiting a very long time, because it's very often exceptionally difficult to get all 8 candles kindled at once. What Beis Hillel says is, Shammai, the Achilles heel in your approach, although it's intellectually correct, you know, there are some people who it's never the right time, right? Yeah, there's something I want to accomplish, there's a great opportunity, I would, but it's not the right time. Why is it not the right time? I don't know. When will be the right time? I'm not sure. Will there ever be a right time? Maybe yes, maybe no. But all I know is now is not the right time. And you know, the terrible nebuch is people go through their whole lives missing out on incredible and beautiful and meaningful opportunities because they think that the timing is not right. So Hillel says to Shammai, you want people to wait until they can muster up the strength to light all 8 candles? That means a person could be waiting a whole lifetime for that, and they miss out on a lifetime of opportunities. No, sometimes in life, you just have to get the fire burning. You just have to start. Light one candle, get it started. And you know what? If you light one candle, it's much easier the next night to light two, to light a second from the first, than to light two from nothing. And if you just make a concerted effort each night to infuse a little bit more light, a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, that's how you rededicate the temple. That's how you rededicate the Beis HaMikdash. That's how you rededicate your life. Beis Shammai, again, telling me, you need to wait for the perfect moment to begin. You need to wait for the perfect moment when you have the perfect foundation, because then you'll be able to build on top of that. Beis Hillel says, no, don't wait. Sometimes in life, you just have to seize your opportunities, as imperfect as they may be, and you have to make things happen. Who is correct? Who is correct? So interestingly enough, if you take a look at number 14, so the Gemara, when discussing the Hanukkah story, this is a Gemara Maseches Menachos. And this is really quite amazing. The Gemara says over here, Rabbi Yosi, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Af Shal Eitz Lo Yaseh. The Gemara over here is not talking about Hanukkah at all. The Gemara is talking about the ritual purity/impurity status of the utensils of the Beis HaMikdash. So the Gemara says that you should not make the menorah out of wood. Kederach Sha'asu Beis Chashmachus Beis Chashmonai. As the Chashmonai did when they came back to the temple. Amru Lo Misham Raya. Is that a proof? Shipudim shel barzel hayu. They had spears. They had spears of iron. V'chipum babat. Then they later coated them with tin. Hashir, and they got a little bit richer. Asom shel kesef. Made out of silver. Chazir hashir, and they came a little bit richer. Asom shel zav. They made it out of gold. Do you understand, my friends, what the Gemara just told us? There is a huge gap in our understanding of the Hanukkah story, because all of us think that when the Chashmonaim came back to the Beis HaMikdash after defeating the Syrian Greeks, what were they missing? They were missing oil. Says the Gemara, they weren't just missing oil. You know what else they were missing? They were missing the menorah. Think about it for just a moment. The Greeks sacked the Beis HaMikdash. The menorah was pure gold. So forget about oil for just a moment. There was no menorah. So you understand this scene. Imagine, put yourself back 2,500 years. And think about, again, those Hashulam walk into the Beis HaMikdash. Now remember, we know what they saw in the Beis HaMikdash. They saw pig carcasses, they saw idols, they saw everything defiling this sacred place. So they figure they want to rededicate. So what's the best way to rededicate? Both in a literal and a metaphorical sense, light the menorah. Only one problem, no menorah. So again, what would logic dictate? What would logic dictate? What would a Shammai approach to life dictate? Look, wait. You gotta wait. Like, let's clean up a little bit. Let's get ourselves together. Let's go ahead and collect some money. Let's get a menorah together. And again, remember, technically speaking, do they have an obligation to light the menorah? If there's no menorah, technically speaking, they have no obligation. The basic major state of ritual impurity, they don't have an obligation. So a Shammai logic would say, you know what? If you're gonna start something, it's gotta be with perfection. You are far from perfection over here, and therefore what? Skip the menorah. But what did the Chashmonaim do? And this is so dramatically amazing. And this addresses Rivka's point as well as to why we place so much emphasis on the Shemen, even though, again, the military victory would seem to be so much greater. Because what happened? They decided that, no, there's an opportunity to do something magnificent here. There's an opportunity to do something of incredible importance. You know what they did? They took their spears. See what they did. They took their spears. They went ahead and somehow they bundled them together. They created a makeshift menorah, and that's what they lit. So if you had to ask yourself, based on the Hanukkah story, who's right? There's no question that it's Beis Hillel. Because what did the Chashmonaim do? The Chashmonaim were faced with a one-candle situation at best. They were faced with incredibly unfavorable circumstances and highly imperfect circumstances. But in life, you have a choice. You could wait for the perfect moment, or you can make the current moment perfect. And what Beis Hillel says is, choose the latter. Sometimes if you sit around waiting for perfection, if you wait around for everything to fall into place, the planets to be in perfect alignment and the galaxies in perfect equilibrium, now I'm ready to act. And you know what? You'll never act, you'll never do, you'll never accomplish. Sometimes you have to seize the opportunities and the circumstances in front of you and learn how to maximize them. That's the shita of Beis Hillel. Just begin with something. You want to rededicate? Just kindle the light. It might not burn bright. It might not burn long. But just get it burning. Because once you get it burning, it'll be so much easier to go ahead and illuminate additional things based on that first glimmer of light. And that's what our ancestors did. That's the Chashmonaim did. According to Beis Shammai, they would have asked the Shaila to Shammai. Shammai would have told them, choose something else. Focus on something else. But at the end of the day, you're not going to be able to do this in the proper way. But they focus like, they paskin like, so to speak, like Beis Hillel. And they said, no, there's an opportunity to do something, let's seize it. Same thing with the Pach Shemen. Same thing with the little cruse of oil. Logic would have dictated that when they only found one cruse of oil with the seal of the Kohen Gadol, what should they have done? Wait. And by the way, no one would have faulted them for that, right? Just wait. In fact, it's intuitive. It's logical. You only have one little bit of oil. What is the point of starting something that you cannot continue? But that's the shita of Beis Hillel. Madlik in Nerach HaNer, we light one candle after the other. Mosif v'holich, ma'alin v'kodesh ve'in moridin. Sometimes in life, you just have to get the rededication started. Sometimes you just have to seize your moment, no matter how imperfect it may be, and start the trajectory of growth. Start the trajectory, ultimately, of becoming more. If you wait in life for the perfect moment, you end up waiting for an incredibly long time. Now, if we loop this all back, we could begin, I think, to understand why there's no mitzvah of simcha on Chanukah. Take a look at number 15. We quoted in number 1, the mitzvah of v'samachta b'chagecha. We quoted the mitzvah of rejoicing on Yom Tov. So the Sefer HaChinuch writes, why is it that we have an obligation? What's the nature of simcha on Yom Tov? So this is very interesting. The Sefer HaChinuch writes, lefi sha'adam nachon ala inyan, shetzarech tiv'o l'smach l'prakim. So you know what the Sefer HaChinuch writes? You know why there's a mitzvah of Simcha and Yom Tov? Because everyone has to be happy at some point in time during the year. Happiness is very important. You know, unfortunately, you have people who think that happiness it takes away from your frumkeit, right? That if I'm really frum, then I'm unhappy, right? And you know, the frummer I am, the more morose I am. And it's not true. You know, there's an Ivdu as Hashem b'Simcha. There's a concept. Happiness is exceptionally important. There you can't. You can't come close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a state of sadness. You can't come close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a state of spiritual or emotional yeyosh. You have to be with simcha. So this is something amazing. Why did God command us v'samachta v'chagecha? Because God was worried that if He doesn't command us to be happy, then what? There may be people who would go through life without being happy. Like this, at least three times a year, you have to be happy. He says, "Kimoshu tzarech ala mazon." The same way that the body needs food, the soul, the heart needs happiness. Al kaponim v'ala menucha v'ala shena v'rotza akel azako. Sima anachnu amo v'tzom hariso v'tzivano laso sa simcha l'shmo l'maniske l'fana b'chol ma'asinu. So God wants us to be happy. This is so incredibly important. Kadosh Baruch Hu wants us to be happy people. So much to the point that He legislates happiness. He says, even if you don't want to be happy. By the way, there are situations like this where even if I don't want to be happy, God makes me happy. For example, Rachman al-Islan, a person loses a loved one, right? Before Yom Tov, person sitting Shiva, person lost a loved one 2 days before Yom Tov. Yom Tov comes, what happens? Shiva's over. God says, I'm forcing you to be happy. I don't want to be happy. I don't want to be happy. I don't feel it's appropriate. It doesn't matter. Kach Baruch Hu said, I have to be happy. Says Sefer Chinuch, God is teaching us the value of simcha. Now the Sefer Chinuch goes on, but there's another reason for the simcha of the Yamim Tovim. If you look at all of the Yamim Tovim, they all represent periods of perfection. For example, Pesach, or I should say perfection slash completion. So Pesach represents a complete redemption from servitude. On Pesach, we celebrate the fact that we became totally free men with absolutely no vestige, no remnant of servitude. There was complete emancipation. Sukkis, what do we celebrate on Sukkis? That HaKadosh Baruch Hu completely redeemed us from the difficulties and challenges of desert dwelling. What challenges did we have over our 40 years in the desert? What challenges? None. None. Even water. Water, remember, water wasn't a real challenge. Water was a perceived challenge. In reality, again, there was complete redemption of the harsh realities of the desert. Shavuos, again, of course, Kabbalah, so reception of the Torah, Sinaitic revelation, represents the completeness that Torah gives to us, that with Torah, ultimately, again, I become a complete individual. So what you see is the theme over the regalim, the Yamim Tovim, of Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkis. There's a mitzvah of simcha because each of them bring to the table an element of completion, either emancipatory completion, or again, a living above nature completion like by Sukkis, or a spiritual completion of Shavuos. But we come to Chanukah. And what is Chanukah? So perhaps the right title for Chanukah is the Yom Tov of imperfection. Chanukah is the Yom Tov of the one candle. Chanukah is the Yom Tov where we learn that in life, there are many opportunities that come our way that are highly imperfect. And all too often in life, we pass on those opportunities because they do not fit into my paradigm or my framework of perfection. And what Chanukah teaches us is that sometimes the most meaningful moments in life come from moments of incredible imperfection. Sometimes the most meaningful moments in life come from times when you seize your opportunity, your imperfect opportunity, and you try to make something of it. Chanukah teaches us sometimes the most meaningful moments in life are those opportunities where I can't get all 8 candles lit. The most I could do is muster up the strength to light one. Chanukah is the Yom Tov of imperfection. Well, if Chanukah is the Yom Tov of imperfection, then what? Then what are you not going to have? You're not going to have a mitzvah of simcha. Because the mitzvah of simcha only comes about when there is an element of completion. Or in other words, that the mitzvah of simcha only is part of an 8-candle experience. But the irony is that Chanukah is not an 8-candle experience. Chanukah is a 1-candle experience, and as such, there's no mitzvah of simcha. But watch this. Go back for just a moment. Go back for just a moment to number 11. So what did we see in number 11? What did the Shulchan Aruch say? Remember, the Shulchan Aruch wrote, Riboy ha-se'udos, shemar ben bohem. Remember again, so now what we've established is there is no se'uda, there is no mitzvah of celebration on Yom Tov because there's no mitzvah of simcha. Why is there no mitzvah of simcha? Because again, remember, according to what we just said over here before, because again, there is no completion. Chanukah is an incomplete Yom Tov. It's a celebration of the incomplete, and therefore, by definition, there is no mitzvah of simcha. So look what the Shulchan Aruch says. Even though, again, Riboy ha-se'udos, shemar ben bohem, heim se'udos ha-reshus, shelo kavam l'simcha. So okay, so if you want to have a suda, you can, but it's a rishus. Look at the Rambam says v'yesh lom, but v'yesh omrim sheyesh kitzas mitzvah beribui suudos. You ever wonder to yourself, what does that lashon mean? It's such a, the formulation of halakha is so strange. Either there is an obligation or there's not an obligation. If there's not an obligation for simcha, do I need the Shulchan Aruch to tell me that I have the ability to have a festive meal? Do I need the Shulchan Aruch? Again, if the Shulchan Aruch tells me that there's no mitzvah of simcha, no mitzvah to celebrate, no obligation for a meal, do I need the Shulchan Aruch to tell me that I'm allowed to have a meal? I'm Jewish. I don't need anyone to tell me I could have a meal. Right? I can have a meal whenever I mean. I don't need the halacha to tell me that. That's understood. You know what the halacha is saying? You know what the Shulchan Aruch is saying? The incredible aspect of Chanukah is that there is no legislated simcha, but there's an incredible opportunity because you could create your own simcha. The halacha can't mandate the simcha because Chanukah is Yom Tov of imperfection. Because Chanukah is not a complete redemptive experience. Because Chanukah is laced with much imperfection and many things are missing from this Yom Tov. But you know what says the Shulchan Aruch? Heim su'udos harishos. We each have a choice. You could rejoice in the imperfection of life because you are maximizing your circumstances. Or you could just simply go ahead and say, I'll just sit back and wait because everything around me is imperfect. The Shulchan Aruch says that's the choice we make on Chanukah. No legislated simcha, because at the end of the day it is imperfect, but harishus biyadi, harishus biyadenu. The opportunity, the option is up to us. I could create simcha on Chanukah. How? By seizing my opportunities, even the imperfect ones. By finding the courage to light one candle, even if I can't go ahead and light eight. No mandated mitzvah of simcha, but at the end of the day, an optional opportunity. So if you bring this all together, what we emerge with, I think, is something absolutely beautiful and wonderful. First of all, we emerge with a fundamental dispute between the Rambam and the Maram of Rotenberg. Is there a mitzvah of simcha on Chanukah or not? Rambam says yes. Maram of Rotenberg says no. Shulchan Aruch Paskins, like the Maram of Rotenberg, no mitzvah of su'uda on Chanukah. But what's the deeper meaning of that? Maral of Prague tells us that the machlokes, the dispute between Mishnah and Beis Hillel, is not just simply an intellectual dispute by Chanukah, but rather it's a life dispute. Beis Shammai says, wait for the perfect moment, launch your life initiatives with absolute perfection, solid footing, solid foundation, that's the only way you're going to be successful. Beis Hillel says, Shammai, I love you, but you're absolutely dead wrong. Because if you wait for the perfect moment in life, the perfect moment never comes. Rather, seize good opportunities, even if they are imperfect. Light one candle, even if you can't light all eight. The Chashmonaim paskind like Beis Hillel. Right? The Chashmonaim lived the Hillel ideal. They saw an imperfect situation in front of them. They could have easily walked away and said, no, if we can't do it right, we won't do it at all. But instead, they saw an opportunity, even though it wasn't the perfect opportunity, and they seized it. And therefore, says the Shulchan Aruch, although there is no mandated simcha on Chanukah, because Chanukah is a day of imperfection, harishus biyadenu. And this becomes such an exceptional life lesson, because the lesson of Chanukah is, keep your eyes open for your life opportunities. As I said before, so many of us sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Right, we just go ahead and we watch life pass us by. And we say, oh, here's an opportunity, not good enough for me. Here's that opportunity, not perfect enough for me. Here's this opportunity, not the right time. And Nebuch, months go by, years go by, decades go by, a lifetime goes by. And a person loses out on so many beautiful opportunities. The message of Chanukah is the message of the Su'udas HaRishus, the message of the one candle. Just as our ancestors seized an imperfect opportunity and tried to squeeze a little bit of perfection from the most imperfect of circumstances, and by doing so, rededicated our Beis HaMikdash, so too if we choose to rededicate and remake and refine ourselves, we must also find the courage to seize even the most imperfect of opportunities and try to squeeze just a few drops of perfection from a sea of imperfection. All right, we'll stop over here. There's no class next week, and Emirat Hashem will continue the week after. I pray the Chanukah to everyone. There is Maariv in the Beis Medrash beginning now. Thank you.